Well, unless I'm just exhausted and need to turn my brain off. But in general, I like something that causes me to do a lot of work to fill in gaps. You know, where everything's wrapped up very tidily, and everyone can all agree at the end of the day because everything's spelled out so explicitly. I find that really boring and tedious. The things where you have to surmise and make assumptions. You have to go out on a limb in order to connect this thing and that thing. And then you might be right, you might be wrong, or you're both right because there isn't a definitive canon about certain gaps in the narrative. I think that's a great part of it.
But it's interesting because the films I saw, you did, which is, remind me the name, please, the name of the film you did.
Mine?
Yeah.
Improbable Parables.
I have something in common with this kind of process.
Yeah.
It's very short.
Yeah.
But also it's related to what you've been describing earlier with your different personas, mm-hmm. you know. I feel that in this film, some of these personas are embodied somehow by these two characters, basically.
Yeah.
So maybe not all the personas are there, or maybe the personas are all within these two characters, you know. So that's kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I certainly I went into that film with partly it was a test to gain experience with the media, and I had a great reason to do so in the fact that it was produced for a competition.
Yeah.
I should plug it if you don't mind, the competition, even though it doesn't exist anymore, but.
Neat.
The competition is called Dead North, and it was started by my friend Jay Bocart and Pablo. Right now, Pablo's last name escapes me, even though I know it. Saravanja. They have a film company in Yellowknife, and they started this film competition. It's a horror film competition originally. It's four circumpolar regions, so the teams have to exist north of 60, but it can be anywhere in the world north of 60. So by the end of the competition a couple of years ago, it ran for about 8 years. It was they were getting entries from Sweden and Siberia and Finland, as well as across northern Canada, Alaska. So it was all over the place. And some of those films went to Cannes and all that, but the film has to be made for the competition, and it's mostly just a lot of fun. It's something to do in the winter in Yellowknife, which is really long, but you'd have films, people who were just like you know, kids making films together in the backyard were submitting, and that was fine, and it was fun, And there's like all these different layers of the quality of film and the stories being told and all that. But it was centered originally around horror films. And then a few years ago, it was expanded to be horror, science fiction, and fantasy. And the limit was simply if you were a first-time entrant, you could only do 5 minutes. And there were a couple elements that were always included in the film that year you had to put in the film in order to qualify. That way you prove that the film was developed for that that specific competition and not just like shoehorned in from something else. Anyway, Jay and I are good friends, and he's always been encouraging of like me trying to get into the medium and practice around that, and he's been super supportive, and we spent a lot of time together talking about it. So I finally, you know, pulled my head out of my ass and put it together. But I went into making that film with simply I just wanted to put a couple of elements together. I wanted something kind of mundane, ritualized. There was an attempt at death, but in reality is actually a form of birth. It was a test in trying to produce the ambiance or atmosphere of the larger narrative that would say be the focus of my whole practice. This like long-term duality of living inside a fantasy and living in reality. So my intention is that what happens at the end of that film is actually the beginning of that, but I wanted to get I wanted to become familiar with the process of that medium, as well as become familiar with like how my aesthetics would work inside of it, including the narrative aesthetics as well as the visuals, and I guess it was developed without wanting to like tie the narrative up completely and have it all wrap up and be clean, but more like these things connect. And it's up to you to make the connections for you. And if I get to correcting you or validating you down the line, then that's great.
It's interesting because the images in this film talks in a very poetic way to the viewer. And the intensity of the exchange between the two characters, even though when they have this direct interaction, it's not super clear because it's more in the dark.
Yeah.
And when they have this, still they're in presence of each other and they look at each other, but they're apart.
Yeah.
Within a big space, which is outside, which is on the Great Slave Lake.
Yeah.
In Yellowknife. And Yeah, that's, and there's a couple of shots where, because I saw this film 3 or 4 times now, there's a moment in the film where we never really see your face in the whole film. It's really, if we could see it, it's in the dark. But there's a time where you're apart outside and there's daylight and we see only your eyes. Mm-hmm. That, and your eyes speaks a lot in a poetic way. It's very intense. You don't know what will happen, but eventually you commit this gesture, which is basically to plunge under the eyes and probably not come back, but which is sometimes a death, but might be a birth. Mm-hmm. Too, since the witch is, you do that in the presence of the witch, so it's like you are crossing to another world.
Yeah.
So it might be a positive thing. It's not necessarily a bad thing. But it's interesting because when we visited Suzanne Jolie yesterday, she saw the film and she said, what is your relationship to death? And then you mentioned that death is part of your work. Most of your work, death is there. But is death, for you as an artist, is basically this passage which is de facto a kind of birth too?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've struggled with suicidal ideation since I was probably around 10 years old, and it's been pretty constant part of my life. I mean, it occurs to me constantly. I visualize it in every context I'm in. Most of the time, it's obviously not a danger. I'm still here, or am I? but it becomes very vivid, and sometimes it becomes so impulsive that it takes a lot of work to hold back. And sometimes I don't even know, because of this whole, like, the process of going through a series of manic episodes, like, I don't even know if I actually ever did come back in some of these cases, that I might be living, like, just this another branch of, like, the quantum reality, right? But from in the earliest days, I wanted to commit suicide primarily because I wanted to be released from a certain form of pain. But I always had this, like, regret in those thoughts about not being able to experience what happens when that pain is washed away. That I wanted to experience what life is like, or existing is like, without the hardship of those feelings. But not knowing how to separate those two. The suffering was so completely a part of my existence that I could only think to kill myself. But I wanted to see what that, like, substrate would look like without the mark of suffering on it. So
yeah,
I kind of pictured that that's what that was, that to kill myself was a way of divorcing myself from the suffering and having an existence. Obviously, at least in this universe, that hasn't happened, but it's always been to me like an idea of that, yeah, in a way a rebirth, or at least a transformation.
You think, like, most of the suicidal episodes, I mean, for everybody maybe, or for a lot of people, have in this subtext this idea that we might be able to born again some other dimension,
yeah,
without what is so annoying that makes, yeah, us kill ourselves.
Yeah, well, it could be. I certainly can't speak for every person that's, yeah, ever thought about it or had to go through it. And there are also, like, there's so many strange, I mean, suicide is one action that's been committed by billions of people throughout history, right?
And for a different reason than in a different context.
Well, there's yeah, the imperative suicide, you, yeah, know, like the scandalized politician who just can't face the consequences of his actions is very different from the severely depressed or bipolar person who is simply contending with these emotional difficulties for their entire life.
Or traditional Japanese mother who believed that now she's a burden, so this is her duty to kill,
yeah,
herself.
Yeah. Yeah. Or, you know, like, oh, I mean, Hitler's suicide is very different from, like, what mine would be like. Or the
Did he die? I thought he was still alive with Elvis and all these people.
Maybe they're all at that that resort in Brazil.
Anyway,
and the original Paul McCartney.
Oh yeah, it's true.
And the second Paul McCartney, because I think we're on our third or fourth now.
God.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different reasons that happens, so it'd be hard to. But, like, the people that live with it, you know, say that live with it the same way that I have. It could be. They may describe the narrative differently. They may describe their experiences with it and their emotions and hopes about it differently. But it could be. I would be very uncomfortable trying to identify it as an absolute, simply because I don't live their lives. And the people that I've spoken with that have really, really attempted to the point where it was an emergency and had to be taken care of.
Right.
You
mean in terms of, because they would do it without missing their project? Like, they would succeed, you mean?
Yeah, I mean, like, I've dealt with the ideation and visualization and have rarely, well, yeah, I've a few times come very close to it, but I've never I've never in a moment actually been, like, say, hospitalized, where it's become such a crisis and emergency that I'm in the middle of it, and if I hadn't been attended to, I would be dead. But I know people that have experienced that. And in talking to them, like, they were at a point that they didn't even care about the idea that there was something else, that they could live a life without that pain.
Yeah. That's common to think about it, but because I've been myself in that position for like 2 years. Every day I was asking myself why I wasn't killing myself. No, but I wonder if, in my case, there was not this subtext that maybe not I, but something from what I consider to be me now would not be just still having some modes of existence without having this burden of suffering so much that it's unbearable to live at that moment, you know. So this is why it's like a just question that popped out. If in the subtext it's this subconsciousness, some people want to kill themselves and who really want to do it, because I think there's probably, it's a bit simplistic, there's two categories of people who want to make suicide. There's the people who pretend they want to make suicide, right, and then they miss their suicide repetitively, uh-huh, on a repetition. Uh-huh. And there's some people who really want to do it, and uh-huh, they succeed, or they're unlucky and it's not succeeding. But I think these are two kind of different suicides somehow.
Yeah.
Because when the people, like some people I know well, did some repetition of a suicide that never works, to me it's after three times, you know, you think, okay, the person didn't really want to do it.
Should have given up the plot. Yeah.
And there's another reason for that. It's not that person don't really want to die. But I know other people who really wanted to die and just did it, and they succeed immediately. Yeah. You know? And if you really want to do it, there's some very efficient way. It's not so easy, but it's way more easier to kill yourself than to kill somebody else, you know?
Well, shockingly, I've lived in context for so long that I have such easy access to it. I mean, like, my job is to clean windows on high-rises. And I'm on the roof of a 17-floor building looking over the edge doing my work.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, the thought occurs to me every time I look over the edge. I'll never do it. I don't believe I would ever do it.
But there's a kind of fascination of the void and what would happen if I jump.
I think a lot of people have that in general as well.
Oh, yes. Every time I go to the top of my building, I look down and that crossed my mind almost every time for a second. You know, I could jump.
The thing that stays my hand on that one particularly, if nothing else, is that I work for a guy who's a very good friend of mine. Like, we're very close, and he's a wonderful person. He's one of my favorite people in the world. That would fuck that guy's life up, because he's my boss. He's like responsible. He's responsible for the safety, everything like that.
And I guess it's the reason of not committing suicide. It's more for the others usually.
I think that stops
us, you know.
Yeah. And if I were to do it, I think I'm too old for it to be really that important, unless I get really famous first. Right? I need to leave a legacy. But if I were to do it, I would need to find a way to do it where it wouldn't impact. I mean, obviously there's, no matter who you are, no matter how alone you think you are, there is going to be someone that is going to be disturbed by that. And it can be really hard to remember that. But I, you know, there's a difference between, like, if I kill myself and then my family's upset about it.
Yeah.
And I kill myself and I basically ruin the livelihood of my boss and my good friend. You know, there is a difference.
Especially if you do that in front of him. It's different than doing it out of, like,
I mean, like, it's,
if you do it out of sight, it's different. But especially that's a part of he gave you that job, so you will feel responsible somehow.
But the thing is that I'm very compelled to, like, in these performances and films, I'm really interested in trying to, I said it yesterday, the surrogate, you know, like the surrogate suicide, the experience it on a almost like a Jodorowsky kind of psychomagic level, just go through with it, but find a way to make it so that I can do that, so that I can have what I was talking about when early on when I was going through this, I didn't sleep at all. I was such an insomniac. I was lying in bed constantly wanting to do it, but then afraid, because I was like, well, if I get rid of it, then I won't have the pain, but I won't exist to experience life without pain. So I kept thinking about what I called sanicide, the idea of letting myself just completely unhinge and start screaming until someone put me in the hospital and took care of me. And I never really fully went through with that to the point where other people knew much about it, although the cutting was really apparent. I'm covered in scars. But I was even ridiculed for that in like school. And it was like, I wanted this sanicide. I wanted someone to help me scrub that misery away and experience like a substrate life without it, or with at least a normal amount that other people seem to be able to live with, which can be a bit delusional too. But I went through a whole process because I didn't really have access to help in any way. And I actually had to devise my own process of crawling out of that, which is a real like character building exercise to identify a situation and then to enact your own therapy completely on your own without access to any resources, without actual professional help from a person, or like this is even before the internet. Like I just had to fucking think about how to achieve my end, my goal. And after about a year and a half, I was able to pull myself out of that severe depression and like move on a little bit. The problems of being bipolar never really went away, but I managed to resolve that crisis at least that time. Subsequently I have gone through more like manic episodes and everything, but
it's interesting, if death or your own death, or you giving yourself your own death, is sublimed.
Uh-huh.
Do you say that in English?
Yeah.
Sublimation. Yeah.
Yeah.
In the artwork.
Yeah.
That dark work, to quote the character in the Cronenberg film, is it in Scanners? I think so. This artist, they visit an artist and is doing these gigantic sculptures, really strange sculptures, and the doctor asks him, or another character, no, the main character asks him, how do you survive with your condition, you know, of being a scanner, of hearing other people's thought in your head constantly? And he just replied, very classic thing, my art keeps me sane, you know.
Uh-huh.
So somehow I guess this is what's happening to you as an artist. Maybe to me, I don't know.
Well, it's funny, it depends on what you want to consider sane, because I think that I've formulated a structure around which a lot of people, like, it's a constructive way to deal with like what neurotypical society would consider delusional, you know. Like I've just framed, I'm lucky enough that it's always been art for me. I've always ever only been interested in becoming an artist, so I chose a path that gives me like a pass into being able to live like the way I do. If I were to try to be something else, living like this would not be an option. And so in a way it's like it's almost the inverse. My art keeps me insane, you know. Like I live in a way in which it's acceptable for me,
yeah,
to live like this.
Yeah.
To see my life like this and to live it, I can experiment with it. I live. It's eccentric and it's weird, and a lot of normal society won't get it, and that's fine. But I remember, I was like basically right out of my first psychosis in college. I was I got really intellectually into Zen Buddhism. Like I was interested on an intellectual level. And it really informed my earliest forms of my own practice. And as a side step of that, I went to a Zen temple in Brooklyn for a while. And obviously, like, that's still going to be a benefit, even if I was intellectually interested. Because it still can give you, meditating can still give you a very good peace of mind. It's very good. And in fact, it forms the basis of how to deal with borderline and bipolar now in Canada, which is dialectical behavior therapy. That's like, you know, it's Zen practice plus cognitive behavior therapy. So it's kind of interesting that I went there, but like Buddhism is presented in a way as like it's accessible to everyone, that it's a solution to everyone's problems. I don't know. Yeah, we could maybe not, but it is intended that it can be practiced by all people, that its tenets are in the John Stuart Mill sense, you can universalize the maxim, right? where it, and I was always confused and fascinated by the Hindu ascetics as well, because these guys were doing stuff that you just like was unsustainable as something that could be for everyone to do. And I had a long thought about that, and eventually brought it up to someone else in my graduate school about that, who was great for having these kinds of conversations. And she was like, well, they're kind of a stand-in for other people. People support these people. Like the regular, the lay society support the ascetics, and through that support are a part of that spiritual awakening. So the ascetic is like a lightning rod for that spirituality, but are channeling that energy to a broader community that aren't participating in the exact same way, but are, so it's like the front edge of a knife, you know? Like, it's the most important part of a knife blade is that the thickness of the very edge that's cutting. But it's so weak if it didn't have the whole rest of the blade behind it to keep it intact, to make that cut. And so that's kind of, sorry, I'm mixing a lot of analogies. This is kind of part of the product of that thing, but yeah. So I think that maybe I lean more to that asceticism because I'm looking for actions that are durational and difficult and become a form of ordeal and transformative process. And certainly not everyone can do that. Although I think we could invite people to learn to invent these things for themselves as well, or invent them for each other, right? Because that's what original rites of passages did. Yeah, it was a transformative process, and we don't have access to that anymore.
But you can do it yourself.
Like, you can, but that's a lot.
This is what we do with art, and but it's interesting when you say my art keeps me insane, because I've been very interested lately by this prefix "in," because "in" is a very interesting prefix, since it means. Also in French, in both in English and French, it means within, like inside, but it also without.
Yeah.
Insoumission, you know, yeah. I'm not a submissive, I'm a rebel.
Yeah.
so in is very interesting, and my friend Alexandre Gurita is using one of these concepts that he called art invisuel, and he say that art invisuel is basically a way to make non-material art, like so totally dematerialized art that you can still live out by creating a kind of economy around it.
Yeah.
So it's interesting because it means that this art is present and somehow there's visual manifestations. It's also an art which is not divorced from the social fabric. Mm-hmm. It's just within the social fabric. It's not in the white cube, you know, or in the black box. Mm-hmm. It's an art which is totally mixed up with daily life, but it's also without art, it's also out of art, but it's in, it's like inside and without.
Mm-hmm.
So this in really interests me.
Yeah.
Thing. So when you say your art keeps you insane, it makes the two things. This in also works.
Yeah. Yeah.
In that sense, you know.
Yeah.
But today. I read that in some psychology book. I don't know if it's Jack Rosenberg, the creator of integrative body psychotherapy, but I think it was in one of these IBP book that in IBP therapy, transpersonal experience is very important. So transpersonal experience is basically a concept developed by Maslow that describe an experience that is outside of the normal way to experience life and reality.
Uh-huh.
So you suddenly have these things that are unusual and that are not, you hear voices or suddenly synchronicity happen. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
It might be a lot of things that we all experience, like voices, you know, what we call the voice listeners now, since we don't want to categorize voice listeners into schizophrenic or any specific label, with any specific label. Well, there's a theory that say we all hear voices.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that for most of the people we have filters and we don't hear them.
Yeah.
And so what is considered to be normal is to have this filter, and what is considered to be abnormal is not having the filter. But what if it's the opposite? You know, if people who have the filter are not right, you know, somehow. Yeah. So it's kind of interesting. Yeah. And indeed, it raises a lot of questions that sometimes may lead to some dead end too, because there's some practical issues to make people with your voices be comfortable and able to live with this, you know. And also, when I say able to live with this, it's about them and about their surroundings. So, but it's interesting how the normalization of the people is kind of in the core of our society. And no, it's not so surprising that, for example, a superstar now in the world, especially, is Jordan Peterson, because this is what he's doing, is trying to make people normal. Mm-hmm. And somehow, and to make feel better, you know. And this is what he always say, that the woke culture don't make some people better, it makes them worse. As if being better, it's so important, you know.
Yeah.
But why is it so important to always feel better and good? You know, you can feel bad, and it can be a very creative way if you can cope with this bad thing without being without being able to live with it, and this is what suicide is about. If it's too difficult, you cannot live, so you kill yourself, or you become sick because this is just a bad situation. But to be uncomfortable in life, it's part of life.
Sure.
And we tend to be in a culture where, on both sides, I was talking about Peterson, which is this stupid, to my opinion, stupid. unsignificant pseudo-intellectual, you know. And on the other side, you have, say, on the other spectrum, the woke culture, that everything that disturbs you is to be like canceled, you know. And so life has to be also very comfortable. And at a certain point, both of these sides have the same ideology.
I was just going to say that. I was literally going to say, aren't they fucking complaining about the same thing?
They have the same thing. Yeah. They just want life to be comfortable enough and always nice, and everything have to be controlled. It's a control freaking way to see the world. So they have something, maybe they share the same ideology. Somehow.
Well, they're both trying to universalize a specific mythology.
Yeah.
Right? And that's kind of what, you know, they talk about how, like, that's what Freud really did. He didn't invent a new science, he invented a new mythology.
Yeah.
And I think that that's what they're doing, both of those sides of the culture. Jordan Peterson is offering a mythology. And that's actually really fine for the most part. The problem is when they're trying to make it absolute.
That this is the problem. It's
necessary. This is why everyone's on the
same. This is when I use the insulting words for him.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I wouldn't. Because but I think he's probably a good clinician. And
Yeah, I mean, like, I haven't delved too deeply, you know, but obviously he comes across my media stream, so I've heard some stuff, and I don't disagree with some of the things that he's talking about. I think that there's certainly powerful things to talk about, and I can get behind some of the concepts, but I just think that, like, in the sense of that Jungian node, like, these people all want everyone to have matching cloaks.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's not the case, because that happens, there's, like, there's culture, but then within culture there are smaller cultures and smaller cultures. Yeah. As you narrow in on an individual, there are, at every stage of that narrowing down, there's a different part of that cloak.
Yeah.
And you can't make that universal.
Exactly. And this is the point. This is why I've been insulting to him, because as many of these people, he have a good, sometimes right analysis of what is happening. Mm-hmm. And sometimes this analysis would be really similar to, like, a leftist would say, like when he had this conversation with Zizek, you know, the web, which is famous. The problem is that when he start to talk about the topic he's pointing out, like he's talking about, he's totally wrong most of the time about the genesis of the problem, and is quite wrong in the solution to bring to the problem, because this solution will be absolutely it will just be a commodity. It will just play on the privilege of a small group.
Sure.
Somehow. Yeah, yeah. So and it won't, like, be inclusive at all. And indeed, inclusion is a very idealistic concept, and it, yeah. it won't be achieved never probably in a total way, which is normal. Yeah. But to be so exclusive, because he pretends to be inclusive, but he's not so... this idea, what he says in his ideology also behind what he's doing is in divorce. There's a divorce between yeah. what he pretends he's defending and what he's really doing and people he hang out with.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a big, weird, connective distortion in his whole presence. On the web, it's like really strange, you know, the way.
Yeah. Well, I think that it's funny that one side of an argument always wants to point out the echo chamber of the other side, but are not really willing to believe that they exist in their own. When we yeah. do, and it's like an information Hubble bubble, you know, like the concept of like the how the universe is so big and it's expanding so fast that there is actually a limit to how far we can see into the universe. There's a literal end to how far we can see, even though it exists beyond that physical capacity, because at some distance from us the universe is expanding faster than the speed of light, and so there's that limit, and that's called the Hubble bubble. It was kind of theorized by Edwin Hubble. So
yeah.
And I think that culturally we're doing that now because of like the way algorithms are moderating our access to media, and it's very difficult it's so convenient, it's so pervasive, it's so lucrative for the people in charge of it, that it takes a lot of work and a lot of effort to return to a time when, like the early days of the internet, when we had like, you had to literally find a URL and type it in. You didn't link, you were like, oh, I heard about rotten.com and now I just want to look at pictures of people being bloody, you know? And people had access. If you look for something, every search query would return the same results.
Yeah.
And now you're being given stuff, you're spoon-fed. And we all make these arguments. And we make these arguments on both sides of these conversations. Both people are fucking, get out of your echo chamber. Like, we all exist in that. I exist in that. That's why I have so many clips lately of Straight Outta Compton. Like when I go on YouTube, it's Straight Outta Compton and how to make things, right? Like it's woodworking and metalworking and some Japanese craft videos and and then like bodybuilding videos, right? like that is it. I'm almost tired of it because like you can't discover anything anymore because you don't know what you're looking for. And that's what I mean by the Hubble bubble.
Yeah.
Because you don't even know that something exists outside of what you're looking for. It used to be that you could somehow stumble across it, but you're being so isolated and insulated that there's no discovery anymore. It's so hard to discover, you know? Like, YouTube's so vast. There's something like, what is it, like every hour there's enough content for, like, there's every minute or every hour there's, like, a lifetime of content uploaded.
Only?
So okay, maybe I don't.
I would think it's more.
It could be more. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, but it's still, even to phrase it, whether I'm right or wrong, but yeah. to phrase it and not be far off is yeah. like, I don't think about it that way.
I would
way.
Say every second.
Every second. Yep. Sure.
Or every nanosecond. Maybe.
Yeah. Maybe. Yeah. It's just so like, I don't always think about that in that way, but that means it's just like, why do I bother trying to keep up with it?
But at the same time, a lot of this content is just repetition of other content.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So,
yeah.
So if you remove what we can consider as repetition, which is already a problem, but anyway, yeah. Probably you have some more reasonable size, maybe like a billion lifetime instead of a trillion lifetime.
Right.
But yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's... So to come back to your work, because I think we've went into very interesting zones of consciousness, you know, or subconsciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you decide at a certain point to start to move around? Because you've been in New York City.
Uh-huh.
And you started to move around, maybe even before that, because you were born in California. What's make you moving from one place to another?
Well, so I was actually born in England. Yeah. And I think that might be the very beginning of it.
So you have a British passport?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
You have many passports.
The migrant, like, it's also fun because I was conceived in Korea.
So do you have a Korean passport?
No. They don't think they honor that part of it. But yeah, because you need regulation, right? You need someone to go in and check conception. Be like, was that a conception? All right, here's your conception certificate.
And your parents were in Korea for work, I guess.
They were in the Air Force.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, I was born in England, and then shortly after my brother was born, we moved to California. My dad grew up in California, and then as a teenager, I moved to Massachusetts to finish high school. Went to college in New York, and I started 2 years in Utica in upstate New York, and then I ended up in Brooklyn to finish college. Then I did graduate school in Scotland, and then ended up in Yellowknife. So
it was basically for study that you moved around, basically, except for Yellowknife.
Yeah.
Which was a kind of peculiar choice.
Yeah.
But it's kind of interesting.
But choosing to go to Scotland was a part of the moving around thing, because I, you know, I probably could have gone to grad school in New York. But I think the issue was, it's kind of weird. Living in some of these places is in itself a cultural capital. I've discovered moving from California, or even going on road trips out of California, I was always like, you're from California? Whoa. It's just like, it's just a place to live, you know. I don't live on a beach with these fucking weird hedonistic teenagers. I lived in the desert, you know.
You were not in Malibu.
I wasn't in Malibu or anything, but no, I grew up in the Mojave Desert. But it was kind of a funny thing to experience that. And then, you know, early days, you know, I'd always wanted to be an artist. It was always a big thing. So early days, going to art school, it was like, where do I go? I got to go to the best place I can possibly go to. And I chose wrongly. Who can really say which is the best art school? But I ended up at a school in Brooklyn. And that's cool because I went to school in New York. But after living in New York for a few years, I started getting frustrated with the idea that there's, like, to a New Yorker's mindset, there was nothing else happening outside of New York. I just found that really frustrating. They might talk about it, but it's more like talking about anything happening outside of New York is more about being trendy and in the know than it is about actually interesting.
When you say outside of New York, that include upstate New York, or upstate is part of New York in these people's mind?
Oh yeah, certainly. I mean, fuck, if you live in Manhattan, they think anything not in Manhattan doesn't count.
Okay, so if you're in Queens...
No, fuck you. You're in the boonies.
And Staten Island is even worse, I guess.
Oh, definitely. I have a friend... my friend from high school, we moved to... I had a friend from high school who we moved to New York at the same time for different colleges, and he went to school in Manhattan, refused to leave Manhattan while I lived there.
But do you think it's still like that? Because I think now...
Oh, he eventually moved to fucking Greenpoint.
Indeed, but now it's...
Well, he moved to Astoria and then Greenpoint.
It's not too far from Manhattan, just a very...
No.
Like,
no.
Yeah,
but
like
he refused.
A couple of kilometers, you know, it's...
But his... his joke is so funny because he still has never forgiven me for leaving New York. But his joke has always been that, like, New York City should trade Staten Island for Hoboken.
For what?
For Hoboken.
What is Hoboken?
It's the city on... It's in New Jersey, right across the river from Manhattan. Well, there's a subway going there.
Okay.
There isn't one going to Staten Island.
Yeah, but Staten Island, there's this bridge.
Yeah.
Which is really well pictured in Saturday Night Fever, and I think that makes it part of New York. Definitely.
Oh, I don't think it'll ever happen, but I just thought it was funny, because like it's like Hoboken's closer to Manhattan than Staten Island is.
Because also Staten Island has a kind of mythology, especially like in cinema, Brian De Palma, Sisters, you know?
Yeah.
It's in Staten Island. I think in Staten Island, I have this special place in New York City mythology now.
Well, I think
whatever you want, you like it or not, it's there to
well,
stay.
My favorite mythology about Staten Island is Wu-Tang Clan.
Yeah.
You know, Shaolin.
They were from there?
Most of them are from Staten Island. And they call Staten Island Shaolin because, you know, they're called Wu-Tang Clan. They're like really into all the Kung Fu movies. So they started like thinking of it as these like dividing, like, these kingdoms all over. It's really interesting. I've got a couple of books on the mythology of Wu-Tang. It's pretty fucking cool. But so basically I was living in New York and I was just getting a little frustrated with the idea, and I thought, like, okay, let's go to grad school. And I have a British passport, so where can I go there? And I initially thought about like Goldsmiths or Slade, but I realized that going to London was going to be probably very similar to living in New York. And I thought, fuck it, man. Like, what is Scotland having going on? What's going on that way? Oh, I found out about it because I was going to my local bar regularly, and there were some students that were on exchange from Glasgow School of Art. And so I would sit there and I would talk to them. And the bartender was from Glasgow. Weirdly, at this bar, the Alibi in Brooklyn, the bartender was always wearing a Celtic hat for Glasgow Celtic. And then I was talking to these kids from the school, so it put in my head, like, okay, maybe Scotland, let's check it out.
But also, since you are a British citizen, it was easy for you to go there and probably get, like, don't have to pay special fees to get to school there. Yeah.
So I actually had to pay full student, international student fees because I wasn't a resident.
Oh shit.
But I didn't have to work on a visa. I could travel there and I could live there. What I should have done is go there for 2 years, get my residence, and then get the reduced fees. But I was stupid.
But it's interesting because every time you move, it's a bit like in your movie. You go through a hole and you end up at the other side.
Yeah. Well, I liked getting smaller because I thought it was really interesting to go to Glasgow, because in New York, people didn't really... There are probably some people involved in the Glasgow art scene. There definitely were people involved in the Glasgow art scene, but it's a smaller place.
Yeah.
And when I was leaving, everyone said to me, well, you want to be an artist, so you're going to have to come back to New York. And that fucking rubbed me the wrong way. It was just like, there is a whole... What are you saying? That, like, no one else in the world's a fucking artist because they're not in New York? That's
no one
so
else.
Fucking stupid.
No, you have to be New York.
So then I went to Glasgow, and I was kind of stupid because Glasgow's kind of the fucking Williamsburg of... No, I liked Glasgow. I don't want to talk shit about it. It's such a huge art scene there. It's massive for the size of the city. And I had a great time and met a lot of great people, and obviously developed quite like a substantial part of my career because I did grad school and then I worked in the art scene there for galleries and other artists. But I kind of got burnt out on a couple of things, particularly living in the city. So an opportunity came up for me to move to Yellowknife, which my wife at the time did not want to go through. I did. We went. We're not together anymore for a number of reasons, but I unfortunately made her leave where she was comfortable. We went to Yellowknife for that opportunity. I'm still there. And I love it there, actually. It's so, it's more than people would assume, but it's still like, it's a mellow, relaxed pace of town. There's still actually plenty to do and vibrancy if you're up for it, but it's like outdoors. My context is great. And there's something really special about being in the front, what's basically a frontier town. If you go there and you can think of doing something, there's pretty much nothing holding you back. And you rarely have competition, you know, like it's so small. Which has made the last week spent with you really great, because I've been like 9 years living in a context where I'm not in an insulated art environment. You know, in Glasgow, New York, I was pretty much nothing but artists and art crowd. And then Yellowknife, there's a couple of contemporary artists and we don't even really hang out much. But I've got a group of friends, and so it's like a diverse intellectual background, and it's really neat to do that. And just the raw DIY culture of Yellowknife has been great. So that's how I picked up snow and ice carving and learning all this stuff. So
I think it's a good conversation. I think maybe we can take a pause or stop here.
Yeah, I'm happy to. Yes,
yeah. And we'll probably do some really light edit, like probably at the beginning when I talk about Inuit culture. I don't think the ideas are really well, it's not interesting enough. So I will probably remove this and start after that.
Sure.
But I will keep the description of the window. So just save that. And I probably add some. It's interesting because also maybe I can keep it going. Your name JD reminds me of a group which was basically a music performance art group from the late 70s, early 80s, named SPK. I don't know if you heard of that. It's like a classic industrial band.
Okay.
And it was very influential to me somehow because of the music. Was very powerful at that time, and they explored different styles. So some styles are really not so powerful, but other albums are super powerful. And the idea of SPK was basically the guy who started that in a mental hospital. He was a nurse. Uh-huh. And he, with some patient, he did his band. Uh-huh. And the band was named SPK after a very old collective of socialists patients in a hospital in Switzerland, I think in the 40s, named Socialist Patienten Collective or something like that, SPK.
Okay.
But then they kept the SPK and it became Surgical Penis Clinic or Seppuku, you know, uh-huh. SPK. Uh-huh. Or what else was there? Solipstick, and there was another one I forgot now. System Planning Corporation.
Some of this is really starting to be familiar to me. I can't remember what I know about them.
It's kind of interesting because I think among the very first interview I've ever did in my life, maybe it was the second or the third, was with Graham Revel from SPK, and one of the questions was, since you started in hospital and you're specialized in schizophrenia, multiple personality, you know, mm-hmm. Is this SPK acronym have something to do with the fact that it can be interpreted in any way? Your band can have many names, mm-hmm. you know, as a person could have multiple personalities, mm-hmm. you know, and I don't remember Graham's answer though, but mm-hmm. but yeah, I think he said yes, and this is definitely at the core of SPK because it started as a kind of art brut, you know, thing. You know?
Yeah.
And it's interesting because this is indeed neurodiversity has such a wide scope.
Yeah.
And we were not, you're not involved in multiple personality disorder at all, but your diagram have this multiple personas, you know.
Yeah.
And that we all have, I think, somehow, if we want to do this exercise to make it an, you know, by writing. And I wonder if this JD also, you didn't apply the JD to these four, there's four of them, right?
Yeah.
To these four entities, their names doesn't necessarily fit to the acronym JD, right?
No.
Yeah.
No, no.
So that's a kind of interesting, because,
no,
because it could.
Yeah, yeah. The multiplicity of JD is contained inside one character as this kind of joke. Like, on my website, I have a random name generator.
Oh, yeah.
So if it's like, what does JD stand for?
And then what is your website so the listener can go there?
It's amoralhouseof.cards.
Okay. Yeah. There's no .com or .org or .com or .com. Okay.
No, the dot is cards. It's dot cards.
Okay.
So Amoral House of Cards.
Amoral Cards. Yeah. I'm curious to see this name generator because I wanted to put a pronoun generator for me,
uh-huh.
That people can call me whatever they like. You know, mm-hmm. they can use the pronouns of their choice.
Yeah.
But also it can be, I think I would even prefer that it would be generated on a random way.
Yeah.
Like to bring this embodiment of John Cage music, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
In terms of a gender.
Yeah, it was tempting to make every character named after a different form of JD, but it just didn't turn out that way because it's an intuitive process as well. I'm not forcing any of my learning about these characters. It's an intuitive process. So my initials are, originally my initials are JDH. So there is that connection because the first two characters were JD and Hubris, and Hubris is an H, and his whole name is three H's, Humble, Hubris, Helgado. And then like Humble Hubris is that, like, is it I don't know if that translates in into French.
How can you repeat the thing?
Humble Hubris.
Humble is Hubris. I don't know what
this Hubris is. Someone defined Hubris for me really succinctly, really well. It was self-destructive arrogance.
So it's an adjective.
No, it's a noun. But it's not an object. It's an arrogance. So Hubris is a Greek. It's a part of Greek literature, like okay. Ancient Greek literature. You know, in stories, when you come across a character whose attitude is so over the top, they're so full of themselves that you know by the end of the story they're going to be killed or knocked down?
Yeah.
That's Hubris.
That's Jordan Peters.
Yeah. I think we're all guilty of it. That's why I like to wear it. And I am hubris to certain communities in Yellowknife.
Okay.
They know me as hubris. I introduce myself. It's kind of interesting because the public face, because of the nature of my practice, is JD. So I'm frequently, if they're strangers, I'm, like I was introduced to you as JD. But like we're getting close enough that I would ask you to call me hubris. Not that it would be an imposition. It's fine to call me either one. But like you're close enough that I think of you as able to call me hubris.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
It's an honor to call you hubris.
But I did think it was interesting that, you mentioned synchronicity, and I like the way symbols line up, and humble hubris. So there's the irony.
Hubris is usually not humble.
No,
it's a little bit douche, right?
It's kind of both, right? So, and then the last name of that character, Halgado, came to me in a dream that I had that I can still very vividly remember about a law firm / t-shirt emporium.
Okay.
And the name of this place, it was a store that was like a big amphitheater.
Uh-huh.
And the title of it, so you'd walk in and it was a law office right in the middle on the floor, and then the galleries, the successive galleries in the amphitheater were clothing racks full of t-shirts, and every single t-shirt was individually different in color, and there were millions of them. So I don't know why this is the case, but then I had that, and the name of it was Halgado and Sam. Just like really, really blood, right?
Yeah.
But like, I don't speak French, but it was just such so weird. It was like Halgado and San, and
wow.
I was like, that's so bizarre. And I've looked up the word Halgado, and I don't. It's not a thing. Nothing. And I don't know where it came from in my head, but I took it as a sign. And so that's the last name for hubris.
Okay.
So JD, and like as JD, 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 and it's like a million different forms of JD, and then hubris is like very specifically H's.
Yeah, it's so, different.
Yeah,
and then entity.
Yeah,
and the others have different letters to start with.
Yeah, Beichel's full name is Beichel Lester Anarchy Godspeed. Because he's mute, but he's a very boisterous person. He's kind of like an animal, like a pet. He's like kind of like Jesus.
Well, they're all males.
I'm sorry.
These characters are all males.
No. Sam is female.
Okay.
Yeah, and she's a teenager.
Oh.
But she's been a teenager for like 300 years.
Lucky girl.
Yeah, I know. I don't know where.
Or maybe she's just that.
Yeah.
Can you imagine being a teenager for 300 years?
Yeah, it's probably pretty frustrating.
Hey, thank you so much.
Yeah, Jimmy. Pleasure. Thank you.
The skies of Iraq, Pakistan, or Yemen. Unmanned, spying, missile launching. Used to wipe out suspected militants without trial. They kill non-combatants too. And they become a deeply controversial American. We'll be right back.
directions on how to use your radio. Find the power button. Turn it to on. Turn the knob to CKUT 90.3 FM. Relax and enjoy.
Listen. You smell something?
I'd call that a big yes.
I feel so funky.
Beckman, get a sample of this. This is hot, Ray.
I'm very excited. I'm very pleased. I want you to get right down there.
Smell something?
All right, folks, it is 1:01 in the morning Eastern Standard Time. You are tuned in to CKUT 90.3 FM, and it is time for another episode right here. Logic Johnson at your service. This week we've got a special theme because some people might not be aware of this, but in the 1940s in the southern areas of Hungary, there was some unbelievable funk music being produced, and we're going to have an entire special this week dedicated to nothing but 1940s.